So Iran is today creating a new world order. It's on display, and we got it for you. So these are the moments, these are the stories that we need you to see today.
We knocked the hell out of Iran. They're dying to settle. They want to settle so badly. We gave them a week off for a funeral because we're nice. I understand sports really well, really well. And that wasn't a foul.
Британские депутаты. Произошло страшное недоразумение. Мы никакая не мягкая сила и уж точно не пропагандистский инструмент Кремля. Упс. Да и ладно. Не очень-то и хотелось.
That is the president of Russia playing along. We're going to explain to you what exactly that is. And you know what? It's kind of funny. This is the Sanchez effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. And today, Iran is preparing to bury their spiritual leader. And I have to admit that at first, I didn't think this was that big of a story. Obviously, it's a big story because he's a very important person and it means something to the country. But I was thinking in terms of maybe not being that important in terms of long-lasting implications, right? But then I started thinking about it, and I started watching what was happening, and I realized I was wrong. Really, this story is already having huge global implications. The funeral has already begun, and it's going to last for at least a full week. Yeah, it's a long process. But the pictures alone, have you seen them? The pictures alone are absolutely mind-boggling when you look at them. I mean, look at this. Look at these pictures. I mean, this is crazy. That's a sea of humanity. I mean, what you're seeing there, that's the capital city, Tehran. It's one of the largest funerals in history. And the number of people attending this solemn event, are you ready for this number? More than 12 million people are there. 12 million. That's more than Lenin's funeral. That's more than Winston Churchill's funeral. That's more than JFK's funeral. More than FDR. More than Queen Elizabeth. In fact, I checked on all of these. More than any British monarch who was ever put to rest. The Iranian people are showing their resolve and they're showing their unity. And think about it. These are the same people who Israel's Netanyahu tried to convince Mr. Trump were on the brink of overthrowing their government. They hated their government so much. Any day now, they were going to come out and be against their government. Well, how wrong was that prediction as we look at these images that are coming in right now? I mean, these crowds are so immense. Even the Western media is copping to it, is admitting it. You see, usually Western media sources, like, I don't know, pick your poison, BBC, CNN, New York Times, whatever, they simply lie about this stuff or they completely ignore it, right? But this story can't be ignored. It's too many people. This is nuts. This is why Reuters, the BBC, and others are actually reporting it accurately in what may be a first for them in terms of reporting anything that has to do with Iran. So the millions and millions and millions of people who have shown up for this funeral of the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, they've had to wait months for this day. They were ready. Remember how he was assassinated, right? He was, and this is part of their ire. He was assassinated by Israel and the United States with a missile attack that also took out much of his family, including his daughter, his 14-month-old grandbaby. 14-month-old. This massive funeral procession moved through Tehran, then to the Shiite seminary city of Qom. Then the former Ayatollah's remains are going to be transported to neighboring Iraq. Iraq, yes, Iraq, for traditional rites. Two other major Shiite shrines will see his remains in Nayaf and in Karbala. And then after that, his body's going to move to his hometown in Iran, where he's finally going to be laid to rest, where he's going to be buried. Look, those images and others that I'm about to share with you are signaling something very important. It's signaling that Iran has arrived on both the regional stage and the world stage. as a force to be reckoned with. No question. And it's not just because of the millions of people in attendance. It's also because of the leaders of the other countries who have chosen to attend and pay their respects, and to do so in a very public fashion. You see, even countries who in the past would not have been caught dead here, would not have shown up, certainly not before the war started, they would have been afraid to show up for fear of retribution from the West, you know, economic matters. No, here they are now. They're there and they're front and center. I've got some of the pictures. You want to see them? Here we go. Let's start with this. Look at this image. This is kind of huge. That's the Prime Minister Sharif of Pakistan. He's surrounded by a large delegation meeting with Iran's President Pezeshkian. There he is. I mean, Pakistan's an ally of the United States, an ally of the Europeans, right? But there they are in Iran with an entire delegation. That's a message. Here's another one. Let me show you the delegation from Iraq. Think about this one. Iraq is a country in which the United States, my country, spent almost 9 years of war and a staggering $1.8 trillion to make it a vassal and an enemy of Iran. Guess what? Didn't work, as these images that we're looking at together now illustrate. What a waste of money, huh? They're now with Iran. In fact, much of both the Southwest and Central Asia countries also attended the funeral, some out of respect, others out of concern for border and political security. Tajikistan, right there, sent a delegation. By the way, so did Armenia, so did Georgia. All of these countries nearby, willing to be seen publicly. There's Medvedev, right? The big three showed up. Russia, of course, that top-level official, high-ranking delegation. China did the same. They're part of the big three. India also was likely pressured by Israel not to attend, but they chose to attend anyway and make an appearance as it, India has to walk this tightrope of relations with the West more so than most, but they were there. Now, I know what you're probably thinking. Okay, Sanchez, what about the Persian Gulf states, right? Well, these are countries that are consistently with the U.S., right? Did any of them show up? There they are. Saudi Arabia sent a team, including their foreign minister. So did Qatar. So did Oman. I mean, I was surprised when I saw this, I have to tell you. Look at these pictures. In fact, in total, more than 100 countries attended. Who would have thunk it, right? Who would have thunk a year ago that this would happen in Iran? Then there are those, of course, and we need to talk about these as well. Let's talk about those who did not show up. For example, not one single European Union country went there or was represented. The UK reportedly was told by the United States not to go, and they did exactly as they were told. They didn't go. The US obviously didn't show up. Duh. Neither did Canada. Neither did Australia. And you know what it is, too? By not showing up, what these countries did was they sent really an important message. Ironically, they are now the ones framing themselves as outsiders. They used to be the insiders. They're kind of now the outsiders. Think about it. Because as this new world order comes together, and we see it coming together in Iran at this funeral, the West, instead of figuring out how to get along with these countries, is closing ranks with each other around this concept that it is, in fact, you know, the old world. We're the old world. See, I don't think that's a bragging rights point. I don't think that's an advantage. In fact, last night on my live stream that I do right after this show, I interviewed former U.S. State Department Chief of Staff Lawrence Wilkerson, right? I used to interview him. I used to interview Larry, the colonel, many years ago, back when I was on CNN, before he was banned from CNN, and then eventually I was fired from CNN. So I guess they were on to both of us. What he told me is that the West is making a huge mistake right now. This is what he told me last night. He said they're making a huge mistake. The United States and the West in general is making a huge mistake in failing to recognize the ascendance and the power of some of these countries, like Iran and Russia and China. Here's Larry.
What's happening in Europe is the Europeans, as you just intimated, stupid. I won't even use Barbara Tuchman's term, wooden-headed. They are leaden-headed, stupidly, are trying to continue bleeding Putin to the maximum extent possible. We got things like Finland offering its soil for nuclear weapons. Lithuania even preceded them. These are
crazy
moves of idiots. We are looking at Putin, who is as circumspect and prudent a leader as you want. I don't care what you call him, but he is not interested in a war with NATO, being confronted with stupid European leaders who want a war with NATO and think the United States will be right there with them. I got news for them. Donald Trump losing in the other theater too, big time in South Africa, having lost dramatically in Southwest Asia, is not about to enter in with them and then come back to our parlous economic situation, which is tantamount to disaster right now.
So President Trump gets in on this as well, by the way, because he had something to say about Iran. And it's very Trumpian, by the way. In typical Trump fashion, he says this about this funeral. Not exactly delicate comment. Take a listen.
We knocked the hell out of Iran. They're dying to settle. They want to settle so badly. We gave them a week off for a funeral because we're nice. It's true.
By the way, I want to share with you now how Iran responded to Mr. Trump. You know, the Iranians have gotten pretty good at this stuff, and they always do it through their embassies. They could probably teach a class on this, but this is how they responded to Mr. Trump. They posted on X, quote, "People can be killed, but ideas cannot. You killed Ayatollah Khamenei, but in reality, you broke a perfume bottle whose scent has spread every place. You don't understand these things because you have neither civilization, nor history, nor honor." You know, one thing Mr. Trump clearly does not understand is football, or as he would call it, soccer, right? I don't say that as a criticism of the president, by the way. I say that because I'm an American, and I can tell you that I'm also no expert on the sport. For me, for example, because I grew up in the United States, just like the president and just like others in America, football is something you throw and you catch and occasionally kick. And that's okay. Different strokes, you know, for different folks. You know, I like banana, you like mangoes, right? Actually, it's the other way around. But here's the reality. Football, spelled with a U, is the world's most watched sport. And football, spelled with two O's, is simply America's top sport. And that's why the world is outraged at what the United States and the president just did at the World Cup. So here, let me explain. There was a U.S. player who was just penalized. The U.S. player is not the one in the blue shirt. It's the one in the white shirt. See him right there? I think he's, like, stepping on the other guy's foot. So he was penalized for a foul during a match, during the World Cup, and he got what's called a red card, which means he is suspended from the next game. That's the rule. But Mr. Trump didn't like the rule, so he called FIFA on the phone, or the president of FIFA, and he changed the rule.
I understand sports really well, really well. And that wasn't a foul. He didn't do anything wrong. And he's our best player, or one of our best players, a very vital player. And he gave him a red card. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't think it meant much. Then I started hearing that that means he can't play in the next game, at least in the next game. I said, boy, that's a big, you know, if it happened to another player, it would have been unfair. But when they take your best player, or just about, they have some great players, but, and they say you can't play, that's very unfair. That's, you know, it's one thing to penalize somebody for the game.
The president of a host country interfering in a sports event. Now, I know. Look, when compared to other more important matters like the war in Iran and the war in Ukraine, which you could argue the U.S. is in large measure responsible for both, this interference by Mr. Trump is rather insignificant, right? However, given both the U.S. and Mr. Trump's reputation for
international bullying, and given the fact that FIFA is seen as one of the most corrupt sports organizations in the entire world, bar none, this action by the president is not going down easy. It's going down hard all over the world, so much so that even some of the EU's members have chosen to condemn it. Look at this headline. This is from Politico, by the way. The EU's FIFA critic is calling what Trump did profoundly corrupt, which is kind of rich, right, when you consider the fact that the EU itself is profoundly corrupt. By the way, think of the irony of what the United States and Mr. Trump had to do to finally get the ire of the European elites, right? An attack on Iran that kills schoolgirls and assassinates the very people that they're negotiating with? Nah, no attack necessary on Mr. Trump there. Provoking a terrible war between Russia and Ukraine? Nope, no criticism of Trump necessary there, or the U.S. Supporting a genocide in Gaza? Nope, no criticism necessary there. Reinstating a football player during a World Cup? Yep, that's it. Now we're going to go after Trump for what he's doing there. That's a reason to criticize the president of the United States. It's amazing when you think about the comparison, right? But wait, the EU has an explanation for this, for their attack on Trump. They're seeming to suggest in this release that sports should be above politics, that it should be about honest and transparent competition, as you see written right there. There it is. Well, however, now think about this. That statement is coming from the same group that decided that the Russian and the Belarusian football or soccer teams or whatever you want to call them are not going to be allowed to compete. Tell me that is not a purely political reason. All right, change gears now. Time for our weekly segment, Eye on Europe with Che Bose, who's joining us now to bring us up to date on something that I think you might find enjoyable, maybe even funny, I dare say. What up, Che?
Yeah, well, Rick, this one, you know, you'd be forgiven for checking the calendars to see is it April 1st, right? because what's happening in the UK right now, forget about Starmer, the most unpopular leader in living history. He's jumped ship, okay, while telling everybody that it's been a great 2 years, but he's left, he's gone. What's preoccupying the British media and the British political elite? A kid's cartoon made in Russia. I mean, you know, I'm serious, okay? Masha and the Bear. Now, Masha and the Bear, here's the UK media's headlines, right? As you say, whatever's going on in the world, Iran, the war in Ukraine, massive problems in the UK societies, immigration, people getting literally decapitated on the streets. What are these boys obsessed with? Masha and the Bear. Now, Masha and the Bear is this phenomenal Russian success story, right? Yeah. It was started by a single Russian animator back in the 90s. He saw a kid on the beach stealing some guy's flip-flops and annoying everybody on the beach, and he created Masha. Masha and the Bear. It's a very Russian, global phenomenon, I'd say. Now, this thing is so big. A single episode on YouTube has 4.6 billion views. Can you imagine?
Wow.
It's got tens and tens of billions of subscribers, okay? And it's based on sort of, you know, family values, you know, good and bad. Be kind, be nice. It's set in a forest glade, you know? But of course, the British MPs have got together and sent a letter to the Secretary of State saying, this is Russian propaganda. It's Russian soft power, you know? Absolutely remarkable stuff. Now, I did a bit of digging into the actual letter. It turns out that the letter wasn't just signed by this guy, Tom Gordon, an unknown UK, surprise, surprise, Liberal MP, okay? Uh-huh. Tom signs the letter, decides that he doesn't like Masha and the Bear. Three Ukrainian MPs, including Kyra Rudik, these rabid Russophobes, who, by the way, haven't been elected since 2019 because the whole parliament in Ukraine hasn't been elected in 7 years, as we know, okay? They also signed the letters as MPs, given the impression that a lot of MPs had signed it. Ukrainian MPs signing letters on British Parliament notepaper about a kid's cartoon. Could it get any more ridiculous?
Yeah.
But of course, look, it's been handled beautifully, I got to say, by the guys who make Masha and the Bear.
Really?
They came up with this incredible little scene, right? poking fun at the whole idea that this is propaganda. It's a kid's cartoon. It's very popular in the States, in the UK. And it's based, by the way, in LA and Moscow. So it's a cross-country collaboration. Sure. The whole project is, check out how Masha and the Bear responded to the British allegations that they're part of a conspiracy of propaganda against the British mind. Yeah, remarkable. Let's have a look.
Уважаемые британские депутаты, произошло страшное недоразумение. Мы никакая не мягкая сила и уж точно не пропагандистский инструмент Кремля. Мы обычный коммерческий мультфильм о дружбе и взаимовыручке. Честно-честно. Упс. Да и ладно, не очень-то и хотелось.
Did Mr. Putin avail himself for that, or did they use some file video?
Yeah, I think it's AI. I think it's AI. But, you know, I think the sense is in Russia and across the world, and people in London, people in Europe here just can't believe that this could possibly be the focus of any intelligent discussion. A kid's cartoon. Like, we know that they've already banned dead Russians. Dead Russians are supposed to scare you. Dead poets, dead composers, Russian ballet, you know, a black Russian cocktail. You could poison you. So this is just a sort of an extension of a real attempt, to socially and politically, but also culturally, suggest that nothing good can come from Russia.
Yeah,
even
no, I know.
Six-year-old kid, doing good stuff. Crazy.
It's such a part of the story, and I try and convince my friends of this, and they ask me what it's like, and I tell them, I said, well, actually, the people of Russia love the West, and you see it everywhere. You see signs in English wherever you go. You listen to the music in the malls, and it's all American or British or Western songs. You talk to them, and they're fascinated by Western culture, and they want to go there, and they want to be friends with the West. And since the 90s, they've been literally, you know, sticking out an olive branch and saying, what do we have to do? We'll share our nuclear weapons with you. We want to be a part of NATO. Let us join the EU. And all they ever get is kicked in the teeth by the Europeans and the Americans. It's almost like, you know, you have somebody who comes up to you and he puts out his hand out and says, I want to be your friend. And instead of shaking his hand, you spit on him. And that's almost what it seems like. I've got an example of this. And I thought of you because yesterday, was it yesterday or the day before? I don't know. I'm getting old and I forget. But I played a soundbite of some dude who supposedly is a lord. I have no idea what the hell a lord means, but whatever. I guess he's a god-like figure. And he was talking about why the British people need to pay more taxes and forget about their welfare. Literally, forget about your welfare. You need to come up with more money and give it to us so we can protect you. And this is why or how he's convincing the British people that they need to be protected. Gene, play this for play this for us.
Things like welfare, they are unimportant when you lose a war and you have Russian Chechen stormtroopers coming down the street, raping women and killing people. I mean, that's how important defense and security is.
Did you hear that? Gene, play it again. Play it again. You got to hear this. It's crazy.
Things like welfare, they are unimportant when you lose a war and you have Russian Chechen stormtroopers coming down the street, raping women and killing people. I mean, that's how important defense and security is.
Forget about your schools. Forget about your communities. Forget about your taxes. Forget about your utilities. I know forget about the inflation situation. You need to give us more money because we need to protect you from those Russian stormtroopers.
Yeah.
Remember, it was the Russians who killed the stormtroopers. We got to bring for the Russian stormtroopers who are coming to rape your women. I mean,
yeah, and of course, we know that there's been a big release of a report in the UK into 250,000 sexual assaults and rapes, not by Chechen stormtroopers, right? So the invasion is coming across the English Channel in little dinghies, dudes in flip flops from sub-Saharan Africa. By their thousands and thousands, the British Navy can't stop them. And it's not Chechen stormtroopers who are a threat to the women of Britain. There are literally hundreds of rapes in the UK a week. It's the highest rape anywhere in the world, the levels of rape. But it shows to me, it's like Masha and the Bear. And it also fits in with what's happening in Iran. As you say, the effort of the West to demonize Iran has put Iran in the focus. It showed the strength of this and the resilience of these people. And the idea of trying to ban Masha and the Bear, I just checked the stats. The viewing for now for Masha and the Bear, in the UK in particular, has gone through the roof also.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know what? You're right. It's comparable to what's happening in Iran, as we were saying earlier in this newscast. 12 million people take to the streets. These are the same people that Bibi Netanyahu convinced Donald Trump would be actually trying to take away or overthrow their government. Oops, got that wrong. The EU and NATO are right now trying to convince the Russian people that they need to turn on Putin. Oops, that ain't working. As a matter of fact, the Russian people are trying to convince Putin that he's too weak, that he's not doing enough, that he needs to attack the Europeans. Yeah.
Remember, Rick, these are the same guys who replaced the Taliban with the Taliban.
Well said, my friend. All right. You're the best, okay? I'll just say that. You're the best. You're my friend, and I'm going to continue to admit to that until you prove me wrong.
Be careful who you tell that. It could cost you a lot of money.
Jay Buzz. Thanks, buddy. When we come back, we're gonna be joined by somebody who thinks, in fact, that organizations like the European Union should mind their own business and not interfere in matters outside their purview. In fact, he thinks that's what all governments and all countries should do, right? Jeffrey Albert Tucker is a renowned American libertarian writer, publisher, and entrepreneur who also advocates for a special brand of capitalism and Bitcoin, did you know? We are gonna be right back. Don't go away. And hello again. I'm Rick Sanchez. If ever there's been a story of interference, since the topic today has been interference, it's kind of what the United States and Israel just did to Iran. It has not gone well, at least not for the United States, certainly not for Israel. Joining us now to talk about this and a bevy of other stories is Jeffrey Albert Tucker. He writes and comments extensively on the problems with not staying in your lane. I think that might be a good way to describe the viewpoint of most libertarians and much of what I read you write. And there are two things in the world today, I think, that have something to do with this. I think the EU certainly doesn't want to stay in its lane. And I think the Iranians have proven to both the Americans, our country, and the Israelis that they should have stayed in their lane. Can you talk about that?
The Iranian situation with Trump was and is the great tragedy of his second term, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, it's roughly like the tragedy of the COVID debacle in the first term. He's surrounded by advisors on all sides, people screaming at him, you know, what to do and how everything's going to be great if he just acts in this sort of bold way. He does act. Violating all of his campaign pledges, undermining the base, infuriating people all over. It was the Iranian action was the least popular war and probably since the end of the Second World War in the U.S. And we've never seen a situation where the U.S. goes to war and the president's popularity declines as a result. We've never seen that before, which makes me think that maybe this is the last great imperial war from the U.S. I mean, I've been saying that since the end of the Cold War, but this time it did seem different because in every previous intervention, where it was Afghanistan or all over Latin America or Iraq, still the American people get rallied and they get patriotic and they're like, okay, we're all in this. I may not like it, but I'm going to support the president. It didn't happen this time. His poll numbers collapsed. And when Trump took a look at the poll numbers and saw that this fantasy that you could kill a religious leader and cause the people to, you know, rise up and overthrow the government in Iran, it's just a pure fantasy. Yeah. As some of his own advisors said, when he saw that this didn't come true, he quickly reversed himself. And I'm going to say this happened within, like a week or two after after the bombs started falling, then he's been trying to figure out a way to unravel it ever since. And ever since, and you know, with a series of fake announcements about oh, we've got a deal, we won, and now the strait is open, and then it wasn't true, and then this happened dozens of times, and after a while, people just stopped paying attention to him. And now the thing has pretty much disappeared from American public life, and everybody's just forgotten about it. The American people are famously uninterested in foreign affairs and are glad to think of themselves as a peaceful people who love barbecues and baseball, and a peaceful commercial republic. The rest of the world does not see it that way. So Trump created an enormous calamity, and he's got midterms coming up for the Republican Party, and is desperately trying to unravel this war situation with Iran and bring prices down and to a more reasonable level with some success to prepare for the midterm. So it was the political calamity that this war created that caused Trump to reverse himself. Mm-hmm. And for, you know, the entire world knows that the U.S. lost this war, whatever that means. I mean, it was a calamity. It was spectacularly unsuccessful. But we are not getting anybody at higher levels in the U.S. who are willing to actually just say that, even though everybody knows it's true. So we're kind of living these two fake realities. We've got the president going, yeah, we obliterated their military and they were desperate for a deal. It's just silliness. It was a calamitous decision that Trump made. It infuriated the base, alienated all of his best supporters, and led to a spectacular inflation that's just been awful for transportation in the U.S. We're trying to unravel that. So he's trying to walk it back. And again, it's a little bit like the COVID situation in late 2020, where he knew he made a series of mistakes and just tried to sort of walk back from it as best he could without ever having admitted error. That's exactly what's going on in this case, too. So,
but, I'm thinking about what happens next. So I'm thinking ramifications, right? I'm trying to play this out in my head. So let's suppose now Trump, knowing the error of his ways, as you so well explained, and as everybody in the world has watched, really stepped in some pretty stinky stuff when it comes to Iran. Okay, that's a given. So here now, along come the Europeans. They're meeting today in NATO, and it seems like they're just frothing at the mouth to go to war with Russia. I have no idea why, but they think they need to go to war with Russia. Okay. So now Trump, having experienced, and I had this conversation, you may have heard me talk about this with my friend Larry Wilkerson, which I'm sure you know, and Larry is seemingly saying that what has happened as a result of this loss to Iran, if we can call it that, is that there's no way in hell now that the president of the United States is going to go along with NATO on any kind of aggression toward Russia, which means they're going to be on their own. Sure, he'll sell them some stuff, but he is not going to he's not going to engage in a war with Russia, which puts Russia.
I think that's right.
Do you agree?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think Trump has lost all interest in these kind of foreign military adventurism and belligerence of all abroad. In other words, he's defaulting back to what his instincts told him in the first place, which is that this stuff doesn't work. It bankrupts the country. It becomes unpopular. It becomes a political liability for him. Mm-hmm. This is why he ran. He was actually, if you think about it, he's been the first president that really, since the end of the Cold War, who ran on a platform of peace with the world, right? And diplomacy first, no more foreign wars. That's a major reason why he is sitting where he is.
Well, that's why you voted. I don't want to speak for you, but that's probably why you voted for him, other than the fact that the other guy was like half dead and then everything else with that. I voted for him because I saw libertarian principles in Trump. I don't think he got it, but I heard him sound like a libertarian, but he hasn't led like a libertarian.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, what Lord Acton says, power corrupts absolute, power corrupts absolute. So this is always going to be a feature, I think, of every politician. And Trump, he drives everyone crazy. I mean, there's not a single person who could possibly agree with everything that he's done day to day. And it becomes so random and so on. Yeah, all that said, he has been a very significant political figure in American history because he rejected the traditional sort of post-war role of a president, which is just to be a sort of you know, like a mannequin, you know, not really doing anything, just like not somebody who actually manages the government,
right?
But somebody who sort of symbolizes the nation. You know, Trump set out to manage the government, and he wants to be in charge of the agencies. There are 420 of them, and the millions of employees, and he wants to have his way with policy, which is a very unusual thing in the post-war period. And presidents don't usually make this demand. So he's, in that sense, he's been, I would say, delightfully disruptive.
Yeah, but he succumbed to the security apparatus. He you know, Jeffrey, I think he has totally succumbed to the war machine, the war profiteers. He succumbed to Israel and Netanyahu. He succumbed to big tech. He's literally succumbed to the guys who don't help me, my wife, my granddaughter, my children. Yeah. They help themselves. And that's where I think he's gone in the direction.
Well,
you know?
This, I think you're speaking to the frustration, because you're looking at the sort of chasm between the hope and the reality.
Yeah.
That became very obvious from immediately following the inauguration. We had about, you know, a good 100 days there. But even in the middle of that, he was bringing these tech titans in to Washington and holding press conference with them, promising them billions in subsidies for whatever they're doing next. So there's always been this element, you know, the good with the bad. And it's hard to be an uncritical champion of him. But as you also point out, the great problem in American life is the problem is that the alternatives to Trump and to the Republicans are some of the craziest, most lunatic people you can possibly ever imagine. I mean, the Democrats do nothing but shoot themselves in the foot, you know, like every single day.
Right.
They had this calamity that just emerged, you know, with this guy named Plattner, I think his name is, in Maine, who had won the nomination, Democratic nomination to replace the Republican for Senate there. And, you know, they picked some oyster farmer, and just groomed him to be a candidate. And then they found out that this guy's got more skeletons than any closet is big enough to hold, right? And so this is all coming out right now.
So let me ask you as a libertarian, then. I want to get into your head, because I read what you write, and you're obviously you're very astute, and you've got your finger on the pulse of American politics. But American politics is in a really strange place right now. I've never in my life seen a time when the American people are coalescing both left and right, where I see my friend Tucker Carlson and my friend Cenk Uygur talking and sharing ideas, two guys who are used to be on polar opposites. So there's something strange happening in America right now. From a libertarian standpoint, I imagine, do you like Thomas Massie? Do you like that kind of thinking?
No, I do like Thomas Massie. He's a good friend of mine. I like him. I like him very, very much. He's a very interesting person, because he and pretty much he alone was broke the. He's taken on the big agriculture and big tech in ways that no Republican really has before. And he's been very bold in speaking out about the Jeffrey Epstein thing. It's because of Thomas Massie we even got the Epstein files in the first place. So he's been consistent, he's been principled, and he came under fire from Trump like nobody's business. So it was actually kind of unbelievable how he was defeated in that primary. Really quite brutal. But I I think he's got a big political future in the U.S. I don't think he's going anywhere. And the other thing I've noticed about Thomas Massey, despite his sort of extremely sweet demeanor and folksy ways, he's got this indefatigable spirit about him. I mean, he's absolutely determined and cannot be bought and cannot be intimidated. And that's really what you want in a kind of a traditional American statesman, ideally.
Are you a Vance guy or are you a Rubio guy? I think I know what your answer is going
to
be.
Well, between the two, I'd have to go with Vance. Rubio worries me because of the warmongering problem.
Yes.
Right?
I mean, yes.
He's got a long history of sort of neoconservative ideology, and I don't know what his interests really are. He worries the heck out of me. Vance has his own issues with too many ties to the technocratic tech bros and so on. Maybe his nationalism is not entirely to my taste, but if I had to choose between the two, I think Vance would be the one. You know, I would say that I've had a kind of a bit of a relationship with, communication with Vance over the years. And I have detected from him sort of more political opportunism than would entirely make me comfortable.
I was talking to Tucker mm-hmm. one day, and I'll just throw this out there. And he said to me, Rick, Vance is much more courageous. He used a different word. Trump, Mr. Vance is much more courageous than Mr. Trump. Trump will fold, Vance will not, when he's actually put in that leadership situation. I think people are judging him right now kind of as a second fiddle, and it's hard to judge. But that's Tucker's take. It doesn't make it right.
Yeah, but I think that's a reasonable take. And recall that when Trump decided to make the decision to go to war with Iran, Vance was not for it, you know, and he was very blunt. By the way, neither was Rubio, which is a bit of a shock. Rubio said this is a fantasy and it's not going to work. So that I don't understand that. Maybe Rubio has an intelligent, aspect to his thinking.
Trump then? Was it the security apparatus guys, the guys with the money, the Pentagon guys, the war prophet?
God, these are weird mysteries. There's no question that he respects Netanyahu.
Netanyahu
surrounded him and said, oh, this is going to be, and the line is like cartoonish, right? Oh, it's not a problem. You go in, you kill the religious leader. These people all love this guy. We get rid of him. This shows how powerful we are. And then the masses will rise up and overthrow the regime and you'll be done. Just like in Venezuela, right? And so Trump said, oh, well, that's a good idea, and went ahead with it. But Vance was not for it. I tell you, I'm a little concerned about the influence of Kushner on Trump. This is a guy who never seems to sort of go away. He's just always lurking in the background.
Kind of weaselly, right? Kind of weaselly, like, you know that term?
Yeah,
that you know it, and I know it. It's like, what are you doing?
He was at arm's length for a long time in the second term, and I thought, well, this is good, this is good. And then suddenly he makes his way back in. And I would like to know whether and to what extent he had some role in pushing Trump over into this war with Iran. I don't really know. The New York Times had a really interesting sort of blow by blow of what went down in the Situation Room, and I could tell that what they said was kind of more or less true, because it was soon after that the White House began to attack all the leakers,
But as a libertarian, it must make you mad to know that scene you just described was being led, according to the New York Times report you just referred to, by Bibi Netanyahu and his staff. Were in the United States, in my country, and they're in the Situation Room holding a briefing, and the President of the United States gives up his seat to let Bibi run the show. I mean, I'm going to use a bad word here, but that pisses me off.
Yeah, no, I get it. And I tell you something else that shows about Trump, that he's a little bit tone deaf in terms of Israeli politics themselves, where Trump's biggest fans in Israel are not fans of Netanyahu. He is not politically popular. And so you're doing the bidding of Bibi is not the same thing as supporting Israel's interests.
No.
And you'd think that Trump would know that. And it only takes you, you know, a few days of being in Israel and understanding the political situation there to get that Netanyahu is not the guy you want to believe and follow on questions of so supporting Israel.
I agree. Nor is he good for Jews. Nor is he. I'll just say it. Nor is he good for Jews. He's my Jewish friends hate him, or so, not all of them, obviously, but some of my Jewish friends complain about Netanyahu, and you know,
all my Israeli friends have been against him for a very long time, especially with the war in Gaza. You know, was just a scandal to the world and undermined support for Israel, which is something that's a grave concern. I mean, this war has not been good for Israel. The Iran war, the war on Gaza, the territorial expansionism, the ambitions, the lies, the surreptitious manipulations. This is all of this stuff does not work in Israel's interests.
Let me ask you this. This is important because you're the perfect guy to talk to about this. I do believe as well, not on everything, but on many things, that the libertarian point of view, you know, that the government needs to stay in its place. The government needs to take care of its people. It doesn't need to go into areas that have nothing to do with what the people want. I mean, that's kind of what libertarianism stands for, but we're so far removed from that right now, because if you look at the Senate in particular and the House as well, and then you go through the cabinet and even the presidency, and not just this president, but the presidents before it, we've kind of lost our way when it comes to our elected officials caring about us. What do you see on the horizon for our country in terms of getting away from that situation? Is it Gavin Newsom on the left?
Ever since the end of the Cold War, I have wanted to see the U.S. become a normal country that rallied around its founding documents and founding principles and worried mainly about fixing up American life. Hmm. And here we are, 30, 35 years later, and still engaged in this sort of a militarism abroad and neglecting the people at home, while the wealth inequalities grow, while the middle class has been utterly decimated. And I tell you some of this other terrible thing. American health insurance is in an advanced state of collapse right now, to the point that people cannot afford it. We've already seen 3 million leave the exchanges this year. It's going to be closer to 5 or 6 million by the end of the year. The latest Department of Labor report about the job statistics, they seem good on their surface, but they're masking what strikes me as a grave tragedy. You look at the worker population ratio or the participation rates, they're collapsing among all demographics. In particular, people above 55 are just dropping out of the workforce.
Is that right?
We are missing, and it's at a greater rate of men than women. So, the rates of disability are soaring. So, and maybe these things are related. I'm not entirely sure, but when you have a country that's too demoralized even to go to the office and go to work or to wake up with some purpose in life, and this is happening to millions and millions of Americans, you've got a genuine crisis on your hands that needs focus and it needs to be addressed before it is too late. And this kind of focus is what we need in our statesmen. And this is what American people are wanting, some focus. I mean, sometimes it's called America First. It's called a lot of different things. But this has to be the primary concern. We've got major problems in this country, not to mention, the level of indebtedness on the part of governments, corporations, and households. I mean, this level of leverage that we're facing from an economic point of view is utterly unsustainable.
Mm. Yeah.
And these are the kind of things that need to be fixed. And any party or any politician that can grab hold of these themes and make them seem believable, like kind of like what Trump did the last time, is got a future. Maybe that's Massey, maybe that's Vance. I don't know what it is, but a restoration of the founding principles for America are essential. Look, we have to recognize the age of empire. The age of American domination of the world is over.
Yeah.
Like that is done. You can see it in
you
the
got,
data.
You got to find some friends, America, that are on the other side, but we don't seem to be willing to do that. I mean, we're pissing all over Russia and Iran and China and even India, and it's like, what are you doing? That's the global South. At least get to know them before you, you know, spit on them or kick them in the teeth.
Yep. And making friends is a good idea for an economy, for a nation in its late stages of empire.
But, hey, final question, because my producers are saying we got to wrap up. But I noticed on your curriculum vitae that you're a Bitcoin guy. You understand it. Bitcoin's going through a bit of a lull right now. Do you see the cycle coming? Will it for people who care about
it? I think that this might be it for Bitcoin. Of course, I've been wrong in the past on this, and some people just say don't give an obituary to Bitcoin just yet, but I don't know. A 41% year-over-year fall in the price from, and if you want to extend it outwards, we went from $120,000 down to $60,000. And
but that's what happens in every cycle. It goes down 50%, I've seen, right? So these guys...
Yeah, but, you know, it's one thing if it falls from $10 to $5. Another thing entirely when it falls from $120 to $60. And there's another thing, too. And I think this is what... There were changes made in the protocol about 10 years ago that throttled its capacity to be used at scale. And this had to do with the block size wars. Now it's extremely expensive, extremely slow. This is not something that anybody's really going to be adopting for trade. It's no longer even considered as a possibility of being an alternative sort of stateless money. That's not it anymore. Yeah. So the ethos of the community has changed. The protocol has been changed, and I'm just not sure.
So you're not bullish.
Yeah,
you're not bullish. Okay.
I really am not, and probably I'll be eating my words, and some people will be making fun of this interview a year from now. But I'm just not seeing it.
Happens
I see
to the best of us, by the way. I've never gotten anything wrong. Right. hey, Jeff, thanks so much. What a great conversation. Thanks. Thanks for the back and forth. I enjoy having a conversation with somebody like you.
Yeah. Give me a call anytime. Glad to be on the show.
You're great.
Appreciate it so
thanks,
much.
My friend. We'll do it again. And that's it for us. You can find us, by the way, of course, on X and on YouTube and on Spotify and on BitChute, where what they do there is a little different. They make sure that nobody can be demonetized and that nobody can be canceled and that none of your content will ever disappear. So good for BitChute for doing those things. Thanks for being with us. And most of all, as I always like to say, thank you so much for letting us into your homes. That's kind of personal, you know? It means a lot to us, so we'll be looking for you again. I'm Rick Sanchez. We'll see you mañana.